it was commissioned by him, I believe. It was he wanted to provide a copy of the Jewish scriptures for the library at Alexandria, but it was very possible that he was prompted by the desire of Greek-speaking Jews to want their children to be able to read the sacred writings. So, according to the one writer here, that it's not entirely clear what the exact motive was. But one of the motives was, we need a copy of the Hebrew scriptures in Alexandria so that we can read it. So we're going to have to translate it into Greek. But apparently there was influence from the Jews. You know, he was influenced by Jews. We would like for our children to be able to read the scriptures. And they're not doing too well with the Hebrew. Does that remind you of anything today? Or in our time? We talk about translations, don't we? I grew up with the King James Version. That's what I still have. And a lot of that's because I still have the same format as the format of the Bible that my parents gave me when I was, I forget how old, 7 or 8, something like that. And so now I can always find scriptures, remembering where they are on the page. It's nice to have that format. But I understand, I like words a lot. I like language. That's I'm pretty weak in math, but I do like language. So I don't mind, when I read the King James English, I can usually understand what it means. But a lot of people don't, especially if they weren't brought up on it. So it's fine to look at other translations and use other translations, but you always have to be careful. You have to study the King James, and you'll find that there are weaknesses with it. You have all the other translations. You'll find some weaknesses with about every translation I've ever seen. But that's good. That's a part of the study. That's a part of our studies. You don't even take a translator's word for what it says. You try to look yourself and see what the passage actually means. And that's good for you, because then you pay a price, you work for your food, and you appreciate it when you get it. Whereas if somebody just tells you what, oh, this passage, this means this, well, you probably won't remember that. But if you had to work for it, you'll remember. So you can see they had the similar problem here. If we could just have a translation that our children could read, as they grow up, and all who are being influenced by the change in language, it would be wonderful. So I think that's neat that there's a similarity to their time and our time here. One of the name of the book, as we said, derives from the fact that the work in translation was done by 72 elders from Jerusalem on the island of Pharos in 72 days. That's pretty good. 72 days to get this work done. Imagine being assigned translation in 72 days. What's that? It sounds apocryphal. Yeah, it does. That's true. It does sound apocryphal. The letter of Aristeas, A-R-I-S-T-E-A-S, the letter of Aristeas, a document supposedly written about 100 B.C. to Demetrius, Ptolemy's librarian, says that Ptolemy Philadelphus sent a request to obtain 6 elders from each tribe of Israel to do the translating, obviously overlooking the fact that 10 of the tribes were taken into Assyria in 722 B.C. and never returned. Well, yeah, I'm not sure about that. There may have been a way that they got a representative of all 12 tribes. I'm not sure about that. Even though they were scattered, they were still keeping track. We know in the book of Luke it says that Simeon was of the tribe of Reuben, was it? Anyway, I think they were still keeping track up to that point. at least some of the Jews were. Some hadn't completely melted into the populations of wherever they were scattered to. There was still a way to keep track of that. But anyway, that's supposedly how it worked, is that 6 elders from each tribe of Israel made up the 72. One of the stories, and like Lewis said, this sounded kind of apocryphal, is that when all these elders were assigned to do this, they were separated from each other, and it was like they supposedly all came up with the same translation, the same wording, which would be almost miraculous, wouldn't it? For everybody to look at the manuscript and use the same wording to translate. But anyway, they cite that story, whether it's true or not, as proof that this Septuagint was really from God, and it was divinely inspired. And again, as Lewis says, the Septuagint included the Apocrypha, in it, I believe. And that's, of course, what we'll talk about tomorrow. Okay, after Ptolemy II, he was succeeded by the 3rd and the 4th and the 5th Ptolemy. Ptolemy V was also called Epiphanes, the illustrious, the great. I don't know if other people gave them these names or if they said, what do you think? If I start calling myself Epiphanes, what would you think? I like it. It's you. Yeah. But anyway, here's Ptolemy V, Epiphanes. During his reign, Palestine was retaken by Antiochus III, that's the Antiochus the Great, the 6th Seleucid ruler in Syria, in one of the many wars of the 3rd century BC between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. That is very cool. Ptolemy V was immortalized in the Rosetta Stone. Everybody know about the Rosetta Stone? If you don't know about the Rosetta Stone, it's real interesting. The Rosetta Stone is in the British Museum over in London. And if you ever get to go to London, you should go to the British Museum and look at that. It's pretty cool. And what's the significance, what's the real important significance of the Rosetta Stone? Exactly right. It's the key to understanding ancient Egyptian, the hieroglyphics. Because it's got the hieroglyphics, and then it's got Egyptian, and then it's got Greek at the top. And why does it have Greek at the top? Because Cleopatra said, we're going to have Greek. We're going to use Greek. We're going to start using Greek. And it was wonderful to see, here's the Greek. Okay, we know what the Greek says. So all we have to do now is compare it to the Egyptian and the hieroglyphics. So it's a very cool connection there. And so apparently the Rosetta Stone talks about Ptolemy V. The Rosetta Stone was named for the town in the Nile Delta where it was found by Napoleon's men in 1799 when Napoleon invaded Egypt. Pretty interesting. It became the key to reading ancient Egyptian inscriptions. It's black granite, roughly 4 feet by 2 feet, 2.5 feet, 4 foot by 2.5 by 1 foot, inscribed in 3 languages, hieroglyphic, Demotic, and Greek capitals. Its inscription, made about 200 BC, is a deification of Ptolemy V by Egyptian priests, commending his policies, expressing gratitude for favors and some matters of current events. And, as we said, Cleopatra is the last of the Ptolemaic dynasty. And I said Cleopatra told everybody to do Greek. Well, it was already being used before that, obviously. She ruled from 51 to 30 BC, and then Egypt, of course, became part of the Roman Empire. Okay, now here's this idea from Josephus about how the Palestine was caught in the middle. Josephus describes the plight of the Jews during the wars between the Ptolemies and Seleucids in this way. Now it happened that in the reign of Antiochus the Great, who ruled over all Asia, that the Jews, as well as the inhabitants of Celesyria, suffered greatly, and their land was sorely harassed. For while he was at war with Ptolemy Philopater, and with his son, who was called Epiphanes, it fell out that these nations were equally sufferers, both when he was beaten and when he beat others. So that they were very like a ship in a storm, which is tossed by the waves on both sides. And just thus were they in their situations in the middle between Antiochus' prosperity and its change to adversity. So they could never win. If the Ptolemies won, they suffered. If the Ptolemies got beat, they suffered. So it was a tough life under the Ptolemies, and while the Seleucids were in power as well. Any comments on the Ptolemies? The Rosetta Stone, two of the seven ancient wonders of the world. The Septuagint. Did you hear something else? Okay, let's think about the Seleucids for a little bit. The Ptolemies were defeated by the Seleucids in the Battle of Bannaeus in 198 BC. About 200 years before Christ came, the Seleucids beat them there and took control of Palestine. The Seleucid rulers included Antiochus the Great, who led, of course, the battle to defeat the Ptolemies for Palestine. Antiochus the Great was followed by Seleucus the Fourth, followed by Antiochus the Fourth, and Antiochus ruled from 175 to 164 BC. And again, what's the capital of Syria? What's the capital of the Seleucid Empire? Antioch. And according to one historian, by the time of Christ, Antioch had become the third largest city in the Roman Empire. That's kind of interesting. The third largest city where disciples would first become known as Christians. Under the Seleucids, the Jews developed two factions. That's where we're coming to the Pharisees and Sadducees. The house of Onias were pro-Egyptian, and the house of Tobias was pro-Syrian. Okay, so we got a difference of opinion over political leaders. And the Syrian king Antiochus the Fourth, or Epiphanes, replaced the Jewish high priest Onias the Third with Onias's brother Jason, a Hellenizer, who planned to make Jerusalem a Greek city. So Antiochus is encouraging this Hellenization of the empire, of Israel. And this period, as you know from history, is one of Israel's darkest. Things look really bad for the Jews under Antiochus Epiphanes. So Antiochus Epiphanes, the Seleucid king, is going to cause a lot of grief for the people of God. Good to see you, Eric. Under this time, a systematic attempt was made to Hellenize the country by force. An edict demanded the fusion of all the nationalities of the Seleucid Empire into one people. Greek deities were to be worshipped by all at this time. Now, if you're a Jew and trying to follow the law, this is not going to work, is it? an elderly Athenian philosopher was sent to Jerusalem to supervise the enforcement of the order. He identified the god of Israel with Jupiter and ordered a bearded image of the pagan deity, perhaps in the likeness of Antiochus, set upon the altar in the temple. The Jews popularly spoke of this as the abomination of desolation. That's pretty bad, isn't it? There's your temple, and you're being told that, you know, your god really is Jupiter, okay? Kind of get that into your minds. Your god is Jupiter. No, he's not. He's not Japheth. He's not the father of the Gentiles. Our god is greater than Japheth. Our god made Japheth, which I think is where Jupiter came from. He came from the father of the Gentiles. Now they're being Hellenized. You've got to go along with this. And Lewis referred to this in his lesson on Monday. Greek soldiers and their paramours performed licentious heathen rites in the very temple courts. Wouldn't that be awful? But you know what it reminds me of? The Greeks were famous for the gymnasium. What does a church have now to get people to come? They have to have a gymnasium. Heard a couple tell that to somebody. Said when they were looking for a church, he said, "Why didn't you come to our congregation?" He says, "Well, you guys didn't have a gym." So what has happened to our way of thinking? We are more Hellenized than we realize, aren't we? The Greek games are pretty big stuff. They said that Alexander the Great knew that politics doesn't really unite a nation. What unites a nation, he said, was sports. That's why the Olympics were so important. You've got to have sports. That gets people together, doesn't it? People can agree on sports. This is my favorite team. I like them too. Yeah. Go team. And so people get so interested in sports. And Alexander was right. For the most part, most people are that way. But we'll get interested in sports. It's kind of like the weather. You know, it's sort of a safe subject in some ways. Not quite as safe as the weather, but it's a good subject. Well, what do you think about that team? You know, what do you think about the Cardinals? Oh, I like the Cardinals, yeah. Is that the Bloomfield mascot? Yep, of course, the St. Louis Cardinals are kind of a big deal. But this is the carnal mind, and why not make Palestine a sports culture, you know? What's wrong with that? And well, bring it into the temple. Why did churches bring this stuff into the church? You know, why did churches do this? Well, here they're trying to do it in Palestine, trying to do it to the Jews. Swine were sacrificed on the altar. Think of what an outrage that would be if you really knew the law and you cared about it to see pigs being offered on the altar. Because you know from the law, that's considered an unclean animal. It would kind of discourage you, wouldn't it, Rodney? Yeah. I guess so. Yeah, it's. I guess I would just lump it all together, that one thing went with the other. That's a great question, Rodney, because, you know, Jesus will refer to this as well. And we know he's not talking about what Antiochus did. Antiochus has already done his work. He refers to the abomination of desolation as what the Romans will do. I don't know what all the Romans did for sure, but I know that one of the things they did was they set up their standard. They set up the eagle in the temple. And that would definitely defile your temple. You know? Imagine the government taking over the church and putting up their flag here.
Eric? There's a Jewish account, I don't know.
I was hoping it wasn't true, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was true. Yeah.
You're gonna do hellish things.
Yeah. Just. Oh boy. So I'm glad you asked that, Rodney. That's good because it is interesting. It makes you think that Jesus would use that again and speak to his listeners as though they were familiar with Daniel. Whenever you see the abomination of desolation. So it may have been like a figure of speech, you know, to just explain anything that was going to defile the temple, going to desecrate it, something that should not be done there, and some things that shouldn't be done anywhere, you know. And yet here they are, they're doing it in the temple. Remember how angry, angry might be the right word, but remember how Jesus reacted to the Jews making the temple a commercialized place. He drove them out physical action, you know, to get rid of this scourge and abomination. So here we have a dark period in this 400-year period, a dark period under Antiochus Epiphanes, where you guys are going to be Hellenized. You're going to become a part of the right culture. This is the right culture. Give up these, you know, keeping the Sabbath. You know, you're open to your enemies when you do that, as Ptolemy said. Just give these things up. They're silly. They're foolish. Andrew? Oh, Peter. Yeah. Ooh, that's interesting. Wow. Very good point. Very good. 2 Timothy chapter 3, where Paul says that they will oppose like Jannes and Jambres did. That's exactly what you're saying. Jannes and Jambres says, we can do that too. We can make snakes. Yeah, we can do that. But they couldn't do everything. But that's the way Satan likes to work, is you're going to turn people off if you just tell everybody, well, what you do is silly. You've got to replace it with something else. This is like what you're doing. This is similar, isn't it? And the holidays are a good example. The holidays are replacements. They are. There is no celebration of the resurrection of Christ. But, oh, yeah, there is. Here it is, right here. It's in the springtime every year. Don't you want to celebrate the resurrection of Jesus? And yet, you mean with a rabbit? With colored eggs? I don't see the connection. Well, it's the same thing. It really is. So it's offered to us as something that's... This is what God wants. Good point, Andrew. Very good. But when we look back and we think, well, how could Jupiter... You know, be the same as God. But, you know, how can all these things that have been passed down be from God? You know, lots of people think they are. So, swine were sacrificed on the altar under Antiochus Epiphanes. The drunken orgy associated with the worship of Bacchus was made compulsory. Amazing. Just amazing. But you know, a lot of people probably thought that was a good idea. Really? Yeah. It's drunken orgy. It's okay now to take part in this? But again, a dedicated Jew would have no part of it. So you're setting up the division here. These are the things that are going to lead to the formation of the parties in the Jewish religion. Conversely, Jews were forbidden under penalty of death to practice circumcision. And Lewis indicated that there was a practice to kind of uncircumcise yourself. Yeah. Just so you wouldn't look out of place when you played in the games, you competed without your clothes on. It was a dark time, wasn't it? Sabbath observance or the observance of the feast of the Jewish year were forbidden. You could not keep the Sabbath. That was the law. Copies of the Hebrew Scriptures were ordered destroyed. We are going to Hellenize you. You will become a part of the mainstream. You'll be in. You'll be politically correct. You will be okay. And all these things were being put upon the Jews. A gymnasium with an adjoining racetrack was built. There, Jewish lads exercised nude in Greek fashion to the outrage of pious Jews. The track races opened with invocations to pagan deities, and even the Jewish priests attended such events. Now, let's see. Who are the priests today? Right. Who are the priests today? We're the priests. Do we attend such events? Yeah, we got to be careful, don't we? Hellenization also included attendance at Greek theaters, adoption of Greek dress, surgery, that's what Lewis was, surgery to remove the marks of circumcision, and exchange of Hebrew for Greek names. A Greek name was cool. A Hebrew name, not so cool. The Jews who opposed the Hellenization efforts were called Hasidim. Hasidim, H-A-S-I-D-I-M. And it sure sounds like Hasidic Jew, doesn't it? Hasidic, the Orthodox. The name Hasidim means the pious. The piety means reverence. It means fear, the fear of God. That's what it means. And the ungodly don't fear God. They don't reverence Him. They don't respect Him. Godly respect God. That's the dividing line. And we show it by the way we act, by the way we talk about God. They developed a resistance movement and attempted a defense of Orthodox Judaism. These were the forerunners of the Pharisees. So you can see how the Pharisees came about. I think we'll have a little bit more about that later. So, Antiochus Epiphanes is the one who's really promoting a lot of this. The spirit of the Jews under the Seleucids, in particular under Antiochus Epiphanes, is described by this historian this way. Unknown to the Seleucidae, they had stimulated a spirit of nationalism among the Jews. See, they were going too far. This is what history is about, isn't it? If you go too far, you're going to get a reaction. That's why the cleverest ones figure out how to do it incrementally, just a little bit at a time, like the old analogy of putting the frog in the water. If you turn up the temperature very slowly, you'll kill him. But if you turn it up all at once, he'll jump out. So they went too far. They overreached. And it got a lot of the Jews to get a nationalistic spirit. We must defend our country. We're going to lose our identity as a people if we don't do something. So they were going too far, and they were going to bring about a revolt. Tired of oppression and years of Gentile dominion, they prayed and conspired to be free. This determination not only produced the Maccabean revolt, but permeated Jewish thought into the New Testament era up to the time of Bar Kokhba, who lived to about AD 135. Among the Orthodox developed a longing for a military, political Messiah who would smash the Gentile war machine. This is why so many were disenchanted with Jesus' teaching and action. So you can see the background here. Is this one of the things that fueled it? It wasn't just carnal desire. It was this nationalistic feeling that we're tired of Gentiles telling us what to do. We're tired of them telling we need to be a part of this culture. We want to be Jews. We want a nation like we had under David and Solomon. So it doesn't mean they were right in their thinking, but you can certainly understand where they were coming from. Any comments or thoughts along those lines? Yeah, very good point, Lewis. We sympathize with things on the religious right. We don't agree with abortion. We don't agree with thinking no, there should never be any mention of God or of saying a prayer at a public event. But at the same time, we don't go along with their methods. You know, you can't turn these things into law. The promoting of Jesus that took place in the first century and then throughout the ages, when it was truly promoted, it was just simply the preaching of the gospel. It wasn't taking over a government and making that government somehow Christian. It was preaching the gospel, being thankful for governments that were cooperative, that did not forbid. That's nice, but the gospel can go even in governments that don't allow it. It has to go underground. It has to go into hiding, so to speak, but it still spreads. It's happened in China, hasn't it? In China, you have all the house churches. When it's not government policy, it's not allowed by the government, but they still keep doing it. They find ways to avoid the government and keep on trying to follow the Bible the best they can. And so the gospel can keep going. They say there are more people in the house churches. One source said there's more people in the house churches than there are members of the Communist Party in China. So they've become outnumbered. And how did it happen? Well, it just happened by people talking to each other and spreading the gospel that way. Same way it's supposed to work today. But some on the religious right, they're trying to do it by, we've got to be Christians. And what is odd, too, is that, like Andrew was saying, they defend these holidays, these traditions. They say that they think by defending these traditions that they're pleasing God. And yet that's not our job. It's not what we're supposed to do. It's kind of like when the Assyrians came up against Israel, against Jerusalem. That speech that Sennacherib gave, that speech that he gave was pretty scary. He says, you can't call out to your God because your king has destroyed the high places. See, he thought the high places were a place to worship God because that's what the people thought they were. But the high places were not a place where God wanted to be worshipped. He didn't want the idols, definitely, but he didn't like the high places either. But Sennacherib mistook that as, see, you guys aren't keeping up your religion. So we don't want to fall into that trap. You don't keep up the religion by keeping up traditions. You keep the religion by simply staying with what God said. Just follow the Bible. So you're seeing the developments here of the two parties, the Sadducees and the Pharisees. And it's going to be an interesting development. Anybody have any closing thoughts before we take our break?